So today we have three more classes left, and today I will do a little bit more of the adversarial search, the alpha beta pruning that we started talking about last time, and then start talking about learning techniques. And then next class would also be learning, and probably part or all of last class would be learning too. Okay, so that's how it's going to be ending up. Questions before I go.
Is the final going to be just a continuation of the second half of the semester, or is it going to be cumulative?
It's a good question. I'm thinking that whatever happens, it's likely to have a lot more emphasis on the second half because we haven't had an exam on that. Okay. I haven't quite decided whether it's going to be just the second half or not, but definitely there's a lot that happened in the second half that hasn't been tested. So, other questions? Okay. So, so we were talking about, we went from Markov decision processes into game tree search. We actually looked at two of the main ideas, min-max search as well as alpha beta pruning. I just want to quickly go over them. So we talked about perfect play, alpha beta pruning, and then we'll do a little bit about resource limits and how we can evaluate the leaf nodes if you don't already know that it's the end of the game at that point. Okay. But let's actually also take a bigger, more broader view. So the kind of games we are considering are essentially, so notice that when we talked about single agents, we considered different kinds of environments for single agents, dynamic, stochastic, et cetera, et cetera. Now if you have two players, present, and then there is still environment to talk about, two players and the environment, okay? So you can then start talking about the kinds of games. So for example, deterministic games and stochastic are chance-oriented games. And then also in the game, do you have perfect information? Do you have imperfect information about the game? Okay. And the ones that we mostly talk about in this lectures on game theory is deterministic games. Okay. The games like checkers, chess, Go, Othello, these are the cases where the entire state of the game is known to both you and your opponent. The only thing that's missing is what the opponent is going to do next. There is no piece of the knowledge of the game that you don't know that the opponent knows. Okay? On the other hand, so you can also have deterministic games with perfect information. Stochastic games with perfect information such as backgammon and Monopoly, where you still, both you and your opponent know just as much, but you don't get to decide which move you are going to make. You have to first roll a die, and then based on what the die comes up, you get to decide your moves are restricted. Okay? And then of course the harder ones, the more interesting games are these where you have both chance and imperfect information. And those are things like poker, Scrabble, and of course nuclear war and bridge and so on. And in fact, the point about nuclear war is not surprising. In fact, most work on game theory got done in the RAND Corporation during the Cold War era. Okay, so much of the advances in game theory happened because we were worried during the Cold War, there was this worry that, how do we actually win the game of nuclear war with Soviet Union? And so there is a lot of formal stuff that got done there. So in fact, it's not surprising at all that nuclear war is thrown there. Okay. So in looking at this, remember that we are here mostly. And you could talk about, it turns out that doing this is not too hard. Okay, because you already remember that you went from MDPs, which sort of take expectation over the nature moves. Okay, And when you have chance, you wind up taking expectation and then minimization and maximization. Okay? So this is not surprising. These, on the other hand, are a completely different beast altogether, and we are not going to talk about them. Okay? In a way, to the extent MDPs are connected to these, this would be connected to PAMDPs, partially observable Markov deletion processes. In fact, these are, you can think of the best model, operational model for these would be multi-agent partially observable Markov deletion processes. Okay, that's what it would be, but we won't talk any further on that. Okay, so we talked about min-max, which basically, you know, if you have the, you know, the basic idea is, let me see, the basic idea is that you grow the tree of moves. You start from here, you consider all your moves, you consider the potential moves that your opponent can make, and the normal min-max essentially says, keep doing it until each of these leaf nodes are solved positions. That means there are definite wins or definite losses, or it's a considered a terminating game position. And once you know the terminating game position, then if it is actually the normal games of type chess and so on, then you essentially have only three outcomes. You win, which is plus infinity, you lose, which is minus infinity, or you draw, which is zero. Okay? But you can also have generalized games where the number of points you get is some real number. Okay, it's a terminal game, and then you get some number of points. And so the issue, of course, is if I have these points, then you know, these are all terminal game positions. Then the question would be, how do I figure out what's the best move to make? Okay, and for that, obviously, assuming perfect rationality on the part of your opponent, what you would assume is, in this case, the opponent would pick the move that is maximally good for them, which is essentially minimally good for you, because it's a zero-sum game. Okay, and then of course in this case, once you come up to here, you pick the move that's maximally good for you. Okay, so that's, you know, in this case 3-12-8, 2-4-6, 14-5-2, so 3-2-1-2, and then from these 3-2-1-2, you pick 3. So the backed up value for this node is 3, and that came because you took that move. Okay, so the idea then would be you are supposed to make that move. Okay, now if you ever grow the min-max tree to terminal nodes and you find the backed up value, that's considered the, you know, if you get to start first, then that is the minimum you're ever going to get. Okay, and if you, for example, in a game where positive means you win, negative means you lose, then for example in this case, there is no way you can lose this game. Okay. In general, this kind of games are not particularly interesting because there is a perfect strategy that can be computed in finite time. Okay. And so you can avoid losing, for example. Now, so a game is considered solved if you can actually grow the entire min-max tree all the way down and then back up the values using minimization, maximization. And then whatever value you get to the root node, that is the best you can do. That's the value of the game for the max player. Okay, and then I also mentioned this idea called alpha beta pruning, where basically rather than grow this tree, the entire tree at the same time, what you would like to do because of the space consideration, you want to grow the tree in the depth first fashion, so that you never wind up keeping this entire tree, right? You know, make the pieces of the tree as needed, and so you do it in the depth first fashion. And in fact, while you're doing depth first, you can also avoid expanding parts of the tree completely. That's basically the alpha beta pruning. And what we said here was, so for example, having done depth first, going all the way here, when you came to here 3, this would have said, I'm going to be less than or equal to 3. And then when you came here 12, now it's going to be less than or equal to 3. When you came to 8, it'll still be less than or equal to 3. Now there are no more children, so I am 3. My bound is 3 now. The actual value is 3. Okay? Now any time a child has an actual value, its parent gets a bound. Okay, so since this is 3, this is going to be greater than or equal to 3. okay? And since that's greater than or equal to 3, now I continue and I'm basically expanding this tree piece by piece, okay, as needed. So at this point, I got a 2 here. Since this has a value 2, this basically says I'm less than or equal to 2. Okay. Now, if this guy says greater than or equal to 3, this is less than or equal to 2, there is no point in looking at what else is there below that node. Just makes no sense, because this guy will never let anything which is greater than 2 up above. And this guy would never take anything that is less than 3 from here. Okay. So this whatever, there could be a huge world out here, but it's completely useless world for you. It never fall on the main strategy of the game, main line of the game. Okay. So at this point, you say cut off. And when you cut, the important thing to remember, of course, is when you cut, you don't know what you cut. In real world, you don't get to see the options and cut, because seeing the options is wasting time. Right? So you would cut here saying, I already have a good deal. There's no way I can do any better in this case. So I just cut. Okay. And so that's alpha beta pruning. And, you know, it continues here, and in fact, in this particular case, after the last one comes, that's when it gets less than or equal to 2. And in fact, had there been some more nodes, I would no longer expand them anymore. Okay, in this case, there are no more nodes, so less than or equal to 2 becomes 2. Okay, your bound becomes your true value. Okay, now this is called the alpha beta pruning, because for each min node, the current bound is called its beta bound. For each max node, the current bound is called its alpha bound. Okay, I find it much better to write in terms of greater than or equal to less than or equal to, instead of thinking in terms of alphas and betas. It's called alpha beta pruning, and in a program you write it as alpha beta, but when you're looking at it to understand what's going on, it's best to think of greater than and less than. Okay. Now, okay, so do you want to do this, or is there any reason to actually do alpha beta pruning again here? Are there any questions on this stuff? Okay, what I would do is I'll keep this as a homework problem and you can do it. Okay, this is one more example. Okay, and then I'll give you the answer for that. And mostly alpha beta pruning is interesting only in the sense of it, because you keep making these local decisions, it looks like magic in the end. But all you have to understand is ultimately what you're doing is a branch and bound sort of argument, except with two players. Okay. Now, properties of alpha beta is that pruning does not affect the final result. This is important to understand. It's not a heuristic in the normal sense of the word, where heuristic, if it's not admissible, you may not get the optimal value. Okay. Here, this is just the correct, it's the right thing to do. Okay, just like branch and bound, you know, when the case of branch and bound, you have a complete solution on hand and you have a partial solution which is already this costly. So you have a complete solution of 10 units in hand. You don't know what is the optimal solution, okay, but there is a partial solution already which is 10 units costly. At that point, there's no point in expanding that any further. And it has nothing to do with heuristics. Do you understand what I'm saying? So the final result is not affected by alpha beta pruning, and whether or not you get the maximal savings depends on the order in which you look at the moves. In particular, here is actually a picture. Okay, this is the picture that you want to understand. This is the, okay. This is the picture you want to understand. This is the best case for alpha beta pruning. This is the very best case for alpha beta pruning on a uniform branch, uniform depth tree. Okay? So notice that if you are here, then you need to come here and look at all these guys before you know its true value. And once you know its true value, then you get a bound for this. And once you get a bound for this, you can start having cutoffs. Okay, and all of this happens if you do this order in this, I mean, so assuming that you wound up looking, so assuming that you made the min-max tree such that the very best moves that max and min can make at any point are always put on the leftmost side. which you don't get to do normally. If you did it, even then this is the best case you can get. Okay? This is the best case you can get. And in the best case, all the dotted lines are the ones that you are not looking at. Okay? And all the solid lines are the nodes that you did look at. And the cute thing, remember I said Knuth actually did an analysis of alpha beta pruning, and the cute thing that he did was he basically realized that in the best case, alpha beta pruning examines only those nodes such that their Dewey decimal representation has all ones, it has ones in all even or all odd positions. Okay, so if you think of this as null, 1, 2, 3, this is 1, 1, 1, 2, 1, 3, 2, 2, 1, 2, 2, 2, 3, and so on. You notice that everything that got expanded has ones in even, in either all the even or all odd positions. Okay? Except, so that basically, that means that there are b power floor of d by 2 d digit sequences such that each sequence has ones in all odd positions and the same number for the even positions. Okay? And then the string 11111 is counted twice. Right, and so you subtract 1 from that. So basically you have b power b of floor d by 2 plus b of ceiling d by 2 minus 1 nodes are actually expanded at level d. Okay, are actually expanded at level d. And now in the unpruned tree there are b power d nodes at level d. Okay, now this basically is b power d by 2, 2 times b power d by 2, which is the order of b power d by 2 nodes. What?
What representation
is this supposed to be? This is Dewey decimal. It's just basically, so this is 1, 2, 3, and the node 1, first child is called 1, 1, second child is called 1, 2, third child is called 1, 3.
But the bit, as far as how they represent
BCD or something, or what? No, all I want you to understand is that every node that actually got expanded, like for example this, has ones in either all even or all odd positions. I'm just giving you a notation for writing these nodes. 212 is a node.
Oh,
212
okay.
is a node.
Okay.
212 starts from null node, goes to the second child at the first level, and then first child of the second child at the second level, and so on. Okay? So, what's interesting then is you are, instead of having b power d nodes, you are only looking at b power d by 2 nodes in the dth level. That is like effectively taking the square root of the branching factor. B power d by 2 can either be seen as square root of b power d. Okay, so it's like effectively taking the square root of the branching factor of the search tree. Or another way of looking at it is that you will see in a minute that in fact oftentimes you don't actually grow the min-max tree all the way to the final level because it's impossible. Okay, the tree would be too large. Okay, so you oftentimes give yourself an amount of time and grow the tree as much as you can during that time. Okay, now if you are doing alpha beta pruning and if you are really lucky, then you can go double the depth in the same given time. If you are really lucky. If you are not at all lucky, you would just do as much work as you did before. Okay, so in fact, that ordering of nodes is important. You have to understand that the example I showed you, if you had just turned the tree around completely, or if you started going this way, right to left, instead of left to right, you won't get the same cutoffs. Okay, which means that since good move ordering is important, you need to, and since you don't know while you are growing the tree, when you come here, when you start here and you get B, C, D, you don't know which order to expand them. Okay? All I'm saying is if you know that B is the very best child, that means finally B is the child that you're going to take, then expand it first. But that's like, you know, circular reasoning. If you knew it, then why would you even expand? So that's where you need evaluation function, which we'll be talking about in a minute anyway. So assume there is a heuristic evaluation function which looks at the board and says this is this good, this is this good, this is this good. It's a fallible evaluation function. It's not always correct. But if you have that, you can use that to order the moves at each level. So you can do the same depth first traversal of the tree, except the children at each level are ordered with respect to how good they are using the evaluation function. Okay, so that's what you wind up doing in alphabet of learning. And as I said, in the perfect ordering, you double the depth, and which is a huge thing, as you'll see in a minute. Okay, now in all the previous cases, I didn't actually show a real game. Now, obviously, each of those nodes are supposed to be board positions. Okay, just to make sure that you get the intuitions right, here is like the simplest game that you can think of, tic-tac-toe. In fact, there are simpler games, one of them which I'll probably make you do. But this is one game which is where, you know, you put crosses and circles, and then the idea is to fill it in such a way that you can stop another guy from putting their marks. And then you want to complete either a cell or a diagonal or a row or a column with your mark, and then you win. Okay. So normally what happens in, you know, Max, suppose this is your turn, so you have an empty board, you consider all the positions that you can put your mark on. Okay. And for each of those positions, you consider what the opponent can do, and so on. Okay, and in this tree, I went all the way here. And in this case, so this is, there are all zeros in a column. So that means my opponent won. So minus one for me, or minus infinity, or minus one for me, the total value. In this case, neither of us were able to claim a diagonal or a row or a column. So it's zero. And in this case, I have a diagonal, so I get plus one. Okay, so this is basically what I mean in terms of expanding the game all the way. Okay, and if you expand it all the way, you notice that they're dot, dot, dot. Obviously, you need to do enough moves such that each leaf node is going to be a dead node, I mean, as a terminal node. It doesn't necessarily mean that, notice that a node can be terminal even without it being full of marks. So for example, here there are empty cells, but still the game is over. So in fact, the terminal nodes can occur in different depths. That's always possible. Okay. So once you have this, you then apply the, you know the terminal values of this, and you can actually evaluate them and then do min-max backup. And then you can also do it using alpha-beta pruning. Okay. Yes.
If you weren't going to take it all the way down to the bottom level, just do one level deep or two level deep or whatever, how would you?
That's the next part. So the problem, of course, is, you know, in tic-tac-toe, you can go all the way. It's a small enough game. You try to do this for chess, you will never get done because the space is too large. Okay? So what you need to do is to stop yourself without, even before you reach the terminal state. Okay, this is the sort of like MDP problems we talked about. If all leaf nodes are terminal sync nodes, then it's easy. If not, then you have to give some sort of an evaluation of that state. And one idea we had was to take the immediate reward for the state. But in this, or you can have some sort of a heuristic value function for that. In this case, for each of the game positions, you need to develop a domain-specific or a game-specific evaluation function. Just like heuristics for single agent search, here is the heuristics for the board games. Okay. Now, what are those? So, the basic idea, is that you would just stop somewhere here. You apply the evaluation functions to those, and you get numbers just like these numbers there. And then you do min max backup to decide which game, which move. What? That's it. We'll talk about it. So let's assume that I tell you, you decide upfront. I mean, there are many ways of doing it. One way is to, for example, say, I'll just go one level deep, make what's the best move, keep it in hand. Then if I still have time, go two levels deep, find the best move. And I can assume that the move that I found with two levels deep is better than the one that I picked with one level deep. You can do it that way, for example. In general, you'll never know what is the best level of depth to go. There are all sorts of interesting heuristic ideas that are there. But in general, The simplest idea is to imagine a uniform depth cutoff. You know, so I'll only go k ply, where k equal to 4 in all directions. And then, you know, so any node which is already at the fourth level, it doesn't have children. Even if it has children, you ignore them. Okay? So, so the normal min-max has obviously the time complexity is b power m, and that's what kills it. Okay? Space complexity can be b times m because you can do depth first traversal. That's what is important to understand. You never need the entire tree to be in the memory at any single time. Okay, now for chess, B is approximately 35, M is about 100 for normal games, which essentially means you need 35 power 100 is the size of the tree, 35 power 100 nodes at the last level before you can do complete min-max. So it's impossible. It is doable in a sort of a theoretical sense, but it's not doable in a practical sense. Okay, so that's why you consider a cutoff. You go up to a certain level, and then instead of, even if it's not terminal there, you evaluate the board position there. Okay, what are board position evaluation functions? Depends on the game. So for for the tic-tac-toe, here is a reasonable one. It says if it is a definite win for max, give it plus infinity. If it is a definite loss for max, give it a minus infinity. If it's a definite draw for max, give it a zero. Notice that this will always be there. So if you actually do see a terminal state, even below the depth limit, you give it its true value because you should know what the game is. Okay? If not, then here is my idea. Number of rows, columns, diagonals still open for max minus number of rows, columns, diagonals still open for min. That's the goodness of the current position from the max's point of view. And a row is considered open for you if your opponent hasn't already put their mark in that row. Do you understand? Okay, that's the idea. So for example, in the beginning, it's the number of rows, columns, diagonals open for max and min are the same, so this will become zero. Okay, so by the time you come here, obviously if you consider this position, you still have everything open for you, and your opponent has three missing. Those three missing. Okay, so that's the kind of reasoning you do to compute that number. Okay, I'm not necessarily saying this is the best way to play tic-tac-toe. It's a reasonable evaluation function. Okay, in chess, for example, normally what people try to do is they develop a whole bunch of features for the game, okay, such as the number of white queens minus number of black queens is the feature F1, okay, and then feature F2 might be something like the control of the center, which is evaluated in terms of, again, the piece positioning. Okay, and having computed all these features, then you take the evaluation of the entire board to be some sort of a linear weighted sum of these features. Yes?
If the program like tic-tac-toe is solvable, but you still only wanted to do a certain depth due to time restrictions or whatever, can you solve it all the way down, store those up?
Yeah. In fact, tic-tac-toe, you can't lose. If you are the person to start the game, you can't lose tic-tac-toe. Okay. In fact, it's only interesting to kids because they don't realize it. You know, if you see older people playing tic-tac-toe, you know, you should tap them on their back and say, you know, find something else to do with life because it's done. Okay. Chess, on the other hand, may well be solved, but we don't know because nobody has actually been able to provide a perfect strategy because you cannot actually do the entire game. Okay. So now, notice that when you start talking about this, depth cutoff ideas, there are two issues. One is, what do you do at the cutoff, which is evaluation functions, and they have to be designed for the game. Okay, they are game specific. The other is, how deep do you go? And that's a much trickier question. As I said, one simple idea is to just pick, some number and say uniformly everywhere I cut it off at that depth. Okay, but there are better ideas. It turns out that one idea, in fact, is to consider this, you know, basically you can do non-uniform depth cutoff where in some lines where the game is moving, I mean the game is not static at that point of time. That means there's too many pieces, you know, in case of chess, there's too many pieces falling down, you know, as you make moves, okay? Now what happens in those cases is, you know, if you go in the previous level, so for example, you are in the root node and you considered one depth and you computed its, you know, computed the backed up value for the root node. Let's say it is 10. Now you went two depth, okay, and you computed its backed up evaluation function. It became minus 10, okay. Then you went three depth and you computed the backed up evaluation function. It became again plus 30. In that case, clearly the game is moving too fast. You know, by just looking one level ahead, you are able to see that the value that you thought your game, that your root node has, is swinging quite wildly. In that case, clearly I know if it is moving that fast, then probably I should go a few more depth until it stabilizes. Do you understand what I'm saying? Now, this exact idea can be made for each leaf node. So here is actually the root node. Okay, what I could do is I could make a default depth of about 5. So every branch would be brought down to depth 5, and then you can at that point of time see whether or not that node should be expanded farther or not. And you do that based on whether its backed up values are changing too rapidly. Okay, if it is changing too rapidly, then it hasn't reached quiescence. And it hasn't reached quiescence, you might go deeper in those directions.
Increasing the depth limit such that one to something larger?
No, not for everybody, only for that node.
Oh.
See, the way we are doing it is everybody will be at least depth 4, depth 5. Okay, but then some nodes will go much deeper. Some branches will go deeper.
It's like a
creation, iteration. It's like IDA star. It will start becoming like IDA star instead of IDDFS. Okay? And, you know, it's actually a very interesting story here because all you know is what has been happening. So think of trying to buy a stock. I don't know whether you have money enough to buy stocks, but, you know, act as if you did. Okay? So you're trying to decide when to buy, right? So last 2 minutes back, it was $10. Now it's become $5. And then a little later, it became $15. It seems the stock is moving too fast. So if you're a day trader, maybe it's a good thing for you to do. Otherwise, if you're trying to, you know, put money in it and, you know, sleep for a whole bunch of time, you may want to say, at least let it stabilize. I don't quite know what its mean value is right now. Now, of course, you could be wrong. You know, it might stabilize and, you know, just until you become, you know, you feel comfortable and you buy the share, and then it will fall like crazy. You never know. You never know the future. Okay. But most people will say, at least wait until there is some sort of a stability, you know, before you buy. Unless you're a day trader, in which case you actually want to buy when there is a lot of quiescence search exactly is doing that. It's looking at the past and seeing if the past is too dynamic, it's not quiescent, then go a little farther until it becomes quiescent. Now the problem with that kind of reasoning, of course, is that even after you go those many levels deep, it may still be, actually, it acts as if it reaches some sort of a plateau, and so you stop there, and then you turn that side, and then a few more levels deep, if you had gone, the backed up value would have changed very significantly. In general, there is a fundamental problem that you cannot get out of when you do limited depth. Look ahead. You can never be sure that you did right amount of look ahead. You can never be sure. Okay? And because you may have looked up to a certain depth and after that things change again. Now you might say, why don't I look up to that depth? Then I'll say after that the things will change. and if you want guarantee, you have to go all the way to the point where each node is terminal. Okay, and the classic case, the example, if you ever forget about this, limited up look ahead games always have what's called horizon effect. What that means is you try to push the inevitable over the horizon so that you will feel good for a while. That's what the search is doing. And the classic example people talk about is what happened before the onset of Second World War. Okay, so Hitler took over Poland. Okay, so you get to decide whether to wage a war on Hitler, which has a large negative value because wars are costly, or let's assume that Hitler just wanted Poland. He liked Poland, and he'll stop after Poland. Okay, so let him take Poland, and he'll stop. So, and then next year, I mean, 2 minutes later, 3 days later, Hitler takes over Czechoslovakia. Should we let him take Czechoslovakia, or should we wage a war, or should we say he'll stop right after this? Okay. Now notice what happened in reality. We did actually do this. I mean, we let Hitler take, Hitler was allowed to take a whole bunch of countries before the actual Second World War started. On the other hand, in the case of Iraq, we decided much faster. We were wrong then, we were wrong here. Both of the times you could be wrong. That's the point, because if you do limited depth search, you can never be sure. Okay, it's just, this is not a problem of the, I mean, it's not something that you could have avoided unless you did the full depth search, which is impossible. Yes. You could do it, but how does it matter? No, but I mean, you lose the game, you lose the game. It doesn't really matter. So the thing is, when you lose the chess match, they won't give you extra points because you actually put up a good fight and still lost the game. You lost it, you lost it. Yeah. So, I mean, you could heuristically penalize certain branches, etc. That's possible. But I think ultimately, the way, you know, an agent playing min-max game would be judged only in terms of the number of games they didn't lose. That's ultimately the only thing that matters. Okay. So there are ideas such as this quiescent search, where you keep expanding some node, some directions deeper until they become quiescent. But then that doesn't mean anything, because right after you stopped, they might again become non-quiescent. And you'll never be sure. In fact, it could have been the case, I mean, you know, it's like everything is Monday morning quarterbacking. You know, I mean, now that the Iraq war failed, we all get to make fun of Bush, okay? And now that the Second World War sort of succeeded, we all get to say, what's his name, Roosevelt was, you know, farsighted. He knew exactly when to start the war. But both of them are bogus. Okay? It's all, you know, rationalization post facto. Okay? It could very well have been the case that maybe Hitler would have stopped after the 17th country. You just didn't realize, you know. And 17 countries, we did let, you know, Iron Curtain have 17 countries, right, or more even. Right? I mean, when after the Second World War started the Cold War, when there were 17 countries on the other side, quote unquote. Right? So you could have actually avoided killing a whole bunch of people. You know, cities like Dresden could have actually been around. You know, and cities like, you know, Hiroshima, Nagasaki may still be around too. So you can never be sure what would have been the right thing to do. Okay? Unless you are actually able to simulate it all the way to the bitter end. And even then, there is this other issue. Is this a zero-sum game or not? Is Hitler bright enough to do the thing that is actually the most damaging to you? Maybe he's not that bright. Right? So that's part of the reason why most of the game theory research got done in RAND Corporation and government-sponsored labs like RAND Corporation during Cold War, because it's very important. We need to figure out how to deal with these kinds of things, especially with imperfect information. So the Second World War is only a very poor analogy because it's not a perfect information game. We didn't quite know what, you know, there is no piece of knowledge that everybody knew for sure. Okay? Yes?
Might be off topic, but continuing your discussion, How do you handle the case where, like a military simulation where the possible moves are infinite?
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, a tank could just sit there, a tank could go left, tank could go
yeah,
right.
Yeah, so that's a good question. So in terms of continuous games, in general, there are issues in terms of continuous Markovization processes as well as continuous games. And what you would wind up doing is parameterize the action space. That's the only way of getting about it. That's one way. I mean, you know, the question that you had could also be asked, what if you had a continuous MDP, where the actions you have are not finite, but they're infinite numbers? Because each action comes with a parameter, you know, turn by 35 degrees, turn by 35.7 degrees, turn by 35.798 degrees. All of them are different actions. Okay? Okay, so that's the deal with the cutting off search. And we talked about why deeper is better, and last time, the reason going deeper does seem to make sense is because there would be trapped nodes in any normal interesting game. In any normal interesting game, there would be trapped nodes, okay, that if you looked little farther enough, you would have seen the trap, and so you would have realized for them you would know the true evaluation, because every evaluation function would give the real value for terminal nodes. And would only give made-up values for non-terminal nodes. Okay, just as every heuristic must give zero to a goal node, whether it's admissible, I mean, for it to be admissible. Okay, and every evaluation function gives correct values for the terminal nodes, including traps. Okay, the advantage, of course, is that by going forward, you can see those trapped values, and then you back it up to realize that what looks like a great position you are in is actually not a great position. Okay, so much so that this argues that you can make games where there are not enough traps, so that going deeper actually worsens your performance, right? And so a guy called Dana Now, you know, wrote a paper long back on game tree pathology, where he made up this game that nobody other than him wants to play, so it's hard to play it as a two-player game, but if you were to play that game, you know, it doesn't have enough traps such that going deeper actually worsens your performance. Okay, that's how you prove your point. You know, this is just English, okay, to actually prove that then the percentage of traps does make a difference, you design a game where there are not that many traps. So there is, the interesting point is all the games that you and I would like to play must have the property that they have shallow traps, even if the ending of the game by win would be too far away. There are enough traps in between such that, you know, things can get interesting.
What do you mean shallow?
Shallow traps means you can lose chess game with 5-6 moves. Okay, basically because it's not the number of, you know, the way that you would think you would lose chess game is when your pieces all are dead and your opponent's pieces are still happy. But really, chess is about your king being able to move. That's it. And if they, you know, you can have a completely full board and your king can't move. And so you're dead. So that's a kind of a shallow death. And you can ignore that. You know, you can say this position is good, this position is bad based on how many of my pieces are there. And, you know, beginning chess players, and I'm a terrible chess player, I hate chess, so everything I talk about chess, you should take it with huge, you know, bags of salt. But I would think that the people who start playing chess generally tend to think, you know, a board position where I have lots and lots of my pieces, I must be happy there. So that's ridiculous. In fact, your pieces can kill you because you have no position to move to. You know, if all of your guys are surrounding you and then the only exit is now taken over by, you know, your opponent, and so you're dead. Okay? That's actually an interesting point because those traps are what makes going deeper interesting. Okay? Before we go forward, I should mention the current status of deterministic games. Checkers is a game where Chinook basically is the computer winner, okay? So in the sense that nobody can play better than the Chinook program in checkers. Chess, Deep Blue, more or less stopped the, you know, human domination. And furthermore, you know, I don't know whether you guys noticed today, Kasparov has been put in jail for 5 days, right in time for, I guess, Chef's discussion here. So not only has he lost to Deep Blue, he also is losing to Putin, so he's going to jail. And then in the case of Othello and Go, Othello, human champions, refuse to compete against computers because they're too good. Okay, and in Go, which is this game that I don't quite know, but apparently this is like a huge thing in Japan and also in Europe nowadays. Human champions don't want to play Go because computers are too bad. So there are two extremes. Okay, now Go, the problem is branching factor is greater than 300. Chess, the branching factor is 35. Go, the branching factor is 300. So just even doing one ply or two ply look ahead is going to kill you. Okay, so in fact, chess masters have always said that we don't do search like you AI programs do. We look at the pattern. Okay, of course, nobody could ever tell whether or not they're telling the truth, because we are extremely good at making ourselves look good when we're describing ourselves. Okay, so looking at patterns looks like a much more interesting thing than doing dumb search. Okay, so obviously Kasparov will say, I do look at higher level patterns. But we can't be sure of whether that is going to be the winning strategy in chess or not, because the guy is in jail now. As far as Go is concerned, that's the only game in town, because doing search has not gotten us anywhere as of yet. Okay, so you can still write lots and lots of papers on Go in IIII and Ichikai. In fact, there are a couple of great papers in the last IIII too. Okay, how many of you know Go? Okay, so I have a grad student who is crazy about it, Will Cushing. So you know, you can play with him. Maybe you shouldn't, because he's not doing any work otherwise. Yes.
It's still finite, right?
What?
It's finite.
It's finite. Yes. It is finite. Yes. Okay. So that's where deterministic games are. And then we also have been making progress in stochastic games and games of imperfect information. The whole poker championship that you heard about, that's obviously not deterministic game. It's imperfect game of chance. And even there, computers can do fine. Okay. Now, actually, one interesting thing, I always ask this question, we cannot actually solve 24 puzzle problems optimally in any reasonable amount of time even now. Okay? And yet, our programs are winning chess championships. Why is that the case? It's because we're playing against dunderheads, that's all. All our programs need to do well in games is to be better than humans. That's all. And humans are not particularly good. So all you need to do is to be better than them. Whereas a 24 puzzles optimal solution is defined without taking humans into account. Okay, I'm not saying solve chess, which is even if you are playing with super rational entity, you will still win. All I am saying is solve chess in the sense of, if you are playing with the normal losers that are called human beings, you should win. And that's actually possible in chess. Okay? And it's still not possible in Go, because apparently we do things that are not yet understood, in terms of at least the search model. Okay, question? Okay. So I'm going to change gears and start talking about the last main topic of the semester, which is learning. And you know, it's been there in the back of our heads through all the rest of the semester. So what I will try to do is basically give you some idea about at least a couple of learning algorithms for a very specific kind of learning task. But before we get there, we'll at least should get some quick idea of the lay of the land. Okay? So remember, this was something like the agent. This is something like the agent design that we looked at one time. Okay, the utility-based agent. The question, of course, is what is learning? Learning is, so you built this agent somehow. You know, there was this issue that, you know, who built this agent, we put in the knowledge required about how the world evolves, how, what my actions do, and all this stuff has been input by you when you wrote the program. But have you put all the information? Probably not. You put some models. Okay? Now, having put that in, the question is, you would say that the machine, the agent is learning if it is able to improve its performance over time. Improve its performance on the same set of tasks over time. That's the basic idea. Okay? Now, of course, the performance improvement has to be, again, with respect to the external performance measure. You can't just say, you know, at the end of every semester, students come and say, I really understood. You know, if you look at me in my heart, I really understood all the material. It's just that the exam doesn't seem to do the justice. Okay? Unfortunately, it's not that we can't trust the agent or the student. It's just that there is no rational way of evaluating that claim. Okay? So the only way you can evaluate it is with respect to the external performance measure. Okay? So it's not enough for you to understand how the world works. Somehow you use that understanding to improve your performance. That's when you say learning has taken place. Okay? Now, what kinds of things can be learned? Basically, everything can be learned. Okay? You can learn how to estimate your state. You can learn how the world is evolving. You can learn about your effects, actions, the effects of your actions in the world. You can learn about which states are good for you, which states are bad for you. Even given the primitive reward circuitry, you still will be able to tell this state will ultimately lead me to a happier state of affairs. Okay, so you're learning that. Okay, so any of these boxes can essentially be learned. So effect, action description, effect probabilities, causal relations in the world, utility models, sensor data implementation models, everything can be learned. Okay. Now, of course, depending on what you're trying to learn, you will wind up having differences in the learning algorithm. The other question, of course, is while you are learning, what kind of feedback is available? Okay. One beauty of this set of lectures is you can almost, you know, it's true for most of the semester, but especially for this part of the lectures, where you can just keep asking yourself, is that the way I learn? And, you know, is this the way I would like my learning to be judged? In terms of semester exams and so on and so forth. And so it's a good analogy to keep in the back of your head. So the question, of course, is what feedback is available? So suppose you take a course and at the end of the semester you get, you know, thumbs up, thumbs down. That's it. Okay? Or you take a course and no thumbs up, thumbs down. If the semester is over and no more semester is over, and then about 5-6 years later you will be told, yeah, you haven't graduated. Because why? Because you didn't actually pass that other course that Rao taught. We just forgot to tell you. Okay? That would be really less feedback. Okay? Or you could say every 3 days we'll give you homework back and this back, and that gives you some feedback. Okay? So the level of feedback matters. And in general, what we actually differentiate between is supervised, unsupervised, and reinforcement learning. Supervised is sort of close feedback. You know, as you're going through your learning, you being given continuous feedback. And we'll see, you know, what supervised feedback means in a specific scenario. Unsupervised, I just leave you alone. Okay? I'll never tell you whether you learned something good or bad. All that matters is your performance did improve. Okay? Reinforcement learning is you would be given basically cattle prods once in a while. Carrots and sticks once in a while. You know, yeah, you're going in the right direction. Here is a carrot. You are stupid. Here is a slap on your face. And from that, you have to figure out how are you stupid and how are you actually smart. Okay? So in the case of reinforcement learning, the biggest issue would be credit assignment problem. What exactly did I do that deserved me this carrot? And if you hate carrots, that's a different story. But, you know, what did I do? Which of the decisions I made deserved me this carrot? And which of the decisions I made deserved me this slap on the face? Okay? In general, if you're trying to learn to be a better chess master, let's say, I can sit with you while you are playing with, you know, Kasparov and keep telling you, you know, this is not the right move to make here. This is not the right move to make here. That would be close feedback. Or you would just play yourself at the end of 3 hours, you know, they say you lost the game. That's still feedback. Okay? Except when you did lose the game, you have to figure out where did I go wrong? and you have to do credit blame assignment yourself. Okay. So what feedback is available, what can be learned, and then also what prior knowledge is available. That also becomes an important issue. It turns out that most learning that we do is always done in the context of what we already know. In fact, people even say that we can only learn those things that we already almost know. In fact, this is a pedagogical, there's a certain pedagogical philosophy which says that you can only learn those things that you already almost know, which is why you don't teach 471 to grade school students. Okay, you kind of make them go through various other courses, and then they have enough of background knowledge that you then start teaching new stuff. Okay. Now, however, it turns out that if you did not have prior knowledge, it would be easier to write a learning algorithm in those cases. Okay. Much of what you will wind up doing in my limited discussion in the next two classes, and it's also the case right now in most of the machine learning literature, is that most of the work is focused on no prior knowledge case. That means the learner knows nothing upfront, and it's just being shown some examples and it's trying to learn patterns from that. Now, we are doing it not because that is the most reasonable type of learning scenario, but because that's the easiest learning scenario to deal with. Okay, and it has nice applications. You know, there are enough applications of that kind of problem that we can get working on what's called tabula rasa, that means blank slate. You come into the world with blank slate, you the agent, and then I show you some examples and you learn the pattern behind it. Okay? And most of the things that we'll talk about this class will be about those, you know, tabula rasa learning. And those of you who have done any machine learning earlier would see that most of the work that you are probably aware of is also starting from scratch. Okay? And in terms of feedback, we will focus more on the fully supervised case. Although the other cases are important, you know, I'm just going to pick on the supervised case. Okay. Now, you know, this is just saying that for the different kinds of performance elements, you can learn to improve different components of that element, and in those cases, what kinds of feedback might be available. It's just a different version of the previous slide. Okay. And again, supervised learning is correct answers for each instance. Reinforcement learning is occasional rewards. Unsupervised, you just left alone. Okay. Now, furthermore, let's see, what else do we need to do with this? Okay. No, I think this is basically, again, saying everything that I said earlier. You can read this back when you go back. One thing I do want to mention is this, which is, learning is being defined as improving performance. That's all. Okay. So the question, of course, is should you have learned new knowledge that you didn't already implicitly know before, or all you need to do is just improve your performance? The answer is all you need to do is improve your performance. Okay. There are two kinds of ways in which you can improve your performance through learning. Case one, you wound up learning a piece of knowledge that's not known to you before. It's not known to you directly, it's not known to you indirectly. Now, to talk about indirectly, we talk about the notion of entailment. Suppose you have a big database of first order predicate logic sentences, okay, and there is a new theorem that I ask, is this theorem true? You can spend a lot of time proving that it is true. Having proved to yourself it is true, you may want to store this. So the next time around, if I come and ask you, is this theorem true? You'll say, yeah, it's true, because I have proved it, and here's the proof. Okay? Now, when you did this, the first time you proved the theorem, that showed that, in fact, it was known to you indirectly, because it was in the logical closure of your knowledge. Okay? So the knowledge has not increased, and yet your performance can increase, because the second time around I asked you to do the same thing, you improve your performance. Okay? So those kinds of learning where the knowledge does not increase, it just gets made more explicit, those are called speed up learning. All they're doing is improving your speed up, improving your performance. Okay? The other kind of learning is knowledge level learning, where you in fact change your knowledge state. You now know more, or at least you now believe more than you believed before. That's fine too. No, I mean, yes. I mean, in fact, there's this question of, so how does prior knowledge, one of the interesting things is how does prior knowledge affect learning? You keep this in mind. One of the issues is we try to learn things which are somehow consistent with what we know. Okay, but sometimes if what we know is wrong to begin with, you have to be, you know, open to the possibility of throwing the old stuff out and keeping the new stuff in.
So now that, say, our knowledge base is smaller, is it still considered more learning? Or?
No, if your performance improves. So for example, right, there was a beautiful, beautiful theory of, you know, how the planetary motion happens. It was, you know, this big a book as to how complex, I mean, you know, one of the things was, of course, people wanted Earth to be in the middle. After all, we are on the Earth, everything seems to be going around us, so Earth must be in the middle. So somebody says there's a mistake with this problem, with this model. So you make it slightly more complex, so that mistake can be taken care of. You say some more problems, you'll make it even more complex. In fact, there are models of Earth-centric theory of planets which can be this big, right? And yet, the entire book had to be thrown out when Copernicus basically came along. Of course, we tried to shut him off, but ultimately we had to throw it off. And so our knowledge shrunk. But why do we call it learning? Because our performance improved. Okay, this bad book was actually worsening our performance. This one small, you know, piece of information, that sun is actually in the middle, not the earth, changed. So it's not the amount of knowledge you have. If it's a performance, that's the important thing to have. I mean, just because you learned something, like, you know, you can come back to me at the end of the semester and say, I know lots and lots of wrong stuff about alpha beta pruning, you know, but I know it, you know, doesn't help. Just know one little right thing about alpha beta pruning, and that's, and, you know, and use it to improve your performance. That matters. Okay. So anyway, so it's worth remembering the distinction between knowledge level versus speed up learning. Okay, in one case, the knowledge that you wound up learning is not in the deductive closure, or it's not entailed by your prior knowledge. In the other case, you know, it is entailed, and yet you throw it in anyway, because you improve performance. Okay, for example, something like if you're learning to be a better chess master, that will always be speed up learning. Because given the rules of chess, there is nothing I can tell you that's not in the logical closure of what you know to begin with. But, you know, computing the logical closure is semi-decidable. Okay, so it does matter to have speed up. Okay. So one, having said that, at that level of different kinds of learning techniques, I mean, different kinds of learning problems, let me just talk about a very specific learning problem. Okay. Called inductive learning or classification learning. So I'm kind of drilling down deep into one specific kind. And here I'm going to give you a set of labeled examples. And what you're trying to do is to use these examples to predict the label of a new example. Okay? Here is a silly scenario that your textbook talks about, so we'll talk about this. This is a bunch of examples that show Russell's restaurant waiting patterns. And ever since this book came about, nowadays when, you know, AI people go to restaurant, they always ask themselves, would Russell wait here? If not, they won't wait either. But, you know, what this was basically showing is, you know, there are different features. Is there an alternative? Is there a bar in the restaurant? Is it a Friday? You know, what kind of, how many people are there in the restaurant? What is the price level of the restaurant, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then estimated wait time. And then given all this, then Russell decides, yes, I will wait, or no, I won't wait. And since you have no better thing to do with your life yourself, you are tagging Russell along, and you are figuring out whether Russell is waiting. I mean, you know at the end of the day whether Stuart actually waited at the restaurant. Okay? My question, of course, is, now if I give you X13, which is a new restaurant, which is again defined in terms of these features, but you are supposed to predict whether Russell will wait there or not. Okay, and your performance would be judged in terms of whether or not you're accurate enough in predicting what Russell himself would have done. Okay, that's basically the learning that's going on here. So now there are examples and they are fully labeled because each of the examples I did provide you whether Russell did or did not wait. Okay, and since it's fully labeled, then it's kind of a fully supervised learning where for each example in the training case, you do know, you know, what the answer is. And then during the test, you will be given new examples and you're supposed to figure out what their label is going to be. Okay. Now it's tabula rasa in the sense that there is no prior knowledge because I'm assuming all I know is these examples. I don't know anything else. I don't even know that, for example, people don't like to wait for 3-4 hours in a restaurant. That you all know. Okay? I know only what's written in the examples. That's what I'm going to assume. Okay? Now, there is actually an interesting scenario that's going on. You notice that on a specific day when Russell did go to restaurant, he may have been wearing wing-tipped shoes. He may be wearing a blue shirt. He had a coiffed hair, and he had Narvi coming along with him. All of that is part of the scenario, but I didn't describe any of that here. Why? Because in essence, I, the teacher, have made the decision that those are not relevant. A true learning will actually won't even tell you that these are the relevant features. Okay? So in fact, the way the prior knowledge comes in is teacher basically knows what is important in learning the pattern and only shows the features, at least removes the features that are completely irrelevant. Like for example, the color of Russell's shirt would be removed from the feature. Okay? We tend to assume that, oh, that's so easy to do, but oftentimes when you have to decide which features are relevant for learning and which are not, it's much harder. Okay? So in this case, the only way the prior knowledge came in is the teacher's prior knowledge was used to decide which features to show you. Okay? So all I need to do is, given these examples, you know, pick up and given a bunch of test cases, I need to label them correctly. Now, all I really care about is that you be able to label them correctly. Okay? And in fact, to label them correctly, I don't really care what intermediate steps you went through. I would say learner 1 is better than learner 2 if learner 1 is able to label the test cases better than learner 2. That's it. Okay. Furthermore, I can also say learner 1 is better than learner 2 if learner 1 is able to learn the same level of performance from 10 examples, whereas learner 2 requires 10,000 examples to reach the same level of performance. Both happen in this class too. Okay, I can say you are a good student compared to this guy because this guy got, you got more marks than this guy. Okay, but then there is this other problem that, in fact, I used to have a colleague who told me that she would always understand the entire semester's worth of material the day after the exam. The day after the exam, epiphany, she knows everything cleanly. But it was just one day too late, right? So she obviously got not particularly good grades. But, you know, from a long-term point of view, she is way smarter than people who just eke through with, like, the pass grade, you know, by the time of the exam. Okay? So the question, of course, is we do differentiate between not only your performance, but also how many examples did you need to reach that performance. And what is interesting is it brings up all sorts of, so if you think in terms of the number of examples that are available for training, 10, 20, etc., 1 million. And if you trained yourself on those examples and then started being tested, okay, think of this as, you know, 10-day course, 20-day course, 1 million-day course of 471. Okay? So you're being given more and more training, right? And then the final exam is about the same. So we keep giving you these final exams from the same distribution of exams. And we see your marks. Okay, and then the question, of course, is that the hope is that most of you would kind of go 100% accuracy, you know, actually magically exactly at the semester length, which is 14 weeks plus one class. That's the hope. That is 14 weeks plus one class of looking at me, you would have reached 100% accuracy. Okay, but really all sorts of fun things can happen. You can have people who would probably, I mean, you could normally more likely, you would have somebody who learns that's it. So this is a person who pretty much shut their mind off around some number of days into the course, and then they reach whatever they reached at that level, and then they never reached any further in terms of accuracy. Okay? And then you can also have something like this, which is this guy also did not get 100% accuracy. Okay, but it looks like if you keep increasing the amount of time spent teaching, they would probably reach asymptotically 100% accuracy. Whereas this guy, whatever they got here. After that, their brain was full. And so they're not going to learn anything further. And in comparing learning algorithms, you're going to compare these, you know, which is a better learning algorithm. Okay, so there are two issues. One is accuracy, the other is sample complexity. That is, how many samples are needed for you to reach the same level of performance? Okay, yes? That's in my course, definitely. So around, yeah, you can, indeed. In fact, there is overfitting. That's actually called overfitting. So you can, at some point of time, you can start actually worsening in your performance as the amount of training increases. That's exactly called overfitting. Okay, and to understand why overfitting occurs is itself an interesting point, and hopefully by the end of next class you will know why it does occur. Okay, so this is the problem, and in general there is one piece that we assume, which is that rather than just improve your performance, I will say you first find a rule that underlies the labeling and then use that rule to predict. So I'm putting structure into learning. You don't just go from training examples to test examples, you just go from training examples to a hypothesis as to what is the pattern, and then from the hypothesis to prediction. Okay, this is an actually unnecessary middle step because it's not required from the beginnings of the examples, but it's a reasonable middle step because any intelligent agent is not likely to be able to remember all the examples that it had seen, because intelligent agents may not have terabyte memories. Okay, and so they still need to kind of remember some compressed pattern in the examples as a rule, and then use that to classify the new test cases. So it is reasonable to think in terms of hypothesis. Okay, make a rule or hypothesis that you think is best able to explain the training data, and then use it to predict the test data. Okay, now, so that's basically the problem, of course, is what should that rule be? What kind of rules are you allowed to have? So as given, even now, the learning problem is just too intractable. Okay, for example, suppose I told you, here are points. Those are points on a curve. Tell me the closed form solution of that curve. Okay, well, is it this, right, or is it that, or furthermore, or worse yet, is it like that? In the sense, in between the examples, the function is doing all kinds of crazy things. Right, but examples it does satisfy. The interesting thing, of course, is this and this red one and this green curvy one, both are good in terms of their fit to the training data, equally good. And why do you think one is better than the other? How do you differentiate between them? Okay, so if you're thinking in terms of curve fitting, what kind of curve are you trying to fit? If you're thinking in terms of hypothesis, what kind of space of hypothesis are you considering? And it turns out that to make learning work, you need a bias. You need a bias which says, I will assume that the underlying pattern in your data is going to be expressible in this limited language. And the more limited the language, the more efficient the learning. Okay? So for a guy who is looking for lines, it's very easy to fit lines to data. I showed you how to fit a line to sine wave data. So just ignore the tops and bottoms, thinking they're all noise, and then just put a nice line through 0 points. That will be a straight line. Okay? So it would be fast. It would be very fast to fit a line. It'll be long. It'll take longer and longer time to fit arbitrary curves. But there are many more curves than there are lines. Although, of course, the space of lines is infinite and the space of curves is infinite. One is a bigger infinity. Okay? In the case of discrete hypothesis, in fact, you can show that the number of, suppose I'm trying to teach you a concept in terms of these features, right? In terms of these features. How many features are there? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, right? 10 features. Assume, let's say, these are Boolean features. If there were just Boolean features, 10 Boolean features. If I don't say anything as to what is the hypothesis space, it could be any Boolean function. It could be any Boolean function. How many Boolean functions are there on 10 Boolean features? 2 to the 10. Okay? With 6 features, let me see, with 6 features, right, you get these many different Boolean functions. That will consider all Boolean functions. Okay? Suppose I told you not all Boolean functions, I'm only considering conjunctive Boolean functions. Only Boolean functions which are made up of conjunction over literals. How many such hypotheses are there? 3 to the n. 3 to the n, because I don't need to have everybody present in the this thing. So each literal can be present, each feature can be present positively, present negatively, or not present at all. So 3 power n. Okay? So by saying I'm only looking for conjunctive functions, I will reduce the number of hypotheses that I need to deal with. Okay? Even, and so in fact, whereas if I'm looking at all Boolean functions, there are many more hypotheses that I need to deal with. Now, in fact, there is a practical reason to worry about the size of the hypothesis space, because there are formal results which show that the sample complexity, which is the number of samples you need to reach a certain level of performance, that sample complexity is proportional to logarithm of the size of the hypothesis space. Okay? Which means Boolean functions cannot be learned in polynomial time, in polynomial examples. See, unlike normal computer science algorithms where you think of complexity of an algorithm in terms of the time it takes, in learning, you want to talk about the complexity of a learning problem in terms of how many examples you need to see before you can be sure what the pattern is. Okay? And if I'm trying to teach you any arbitrary Boolean function, you would need to see exponential number of examples before you can be sure. Whereas if I tell you beforehand, I'm going to teach you a conjunctive function, then you only need to see polynomial number of examples, because log of 3 power n is polynomial in n. Okay? So the important point that we will end with this class with is that you need a bias which reduces the space of hypothesis that you're going to consider. Now, biases come in millions of forms. There are different kinds of biases. Okay? The one bias that I already mentioned that humans use, for example, is whole object bias. And I told you the Gaugai hypothesis, you know, where I say Gaugai and the kid thinks the entire thing flitting past him or her is Gaugai, not its eyes, not its tail. Okay? You just jump to the conclusion just so that learning is feasible. Now, for Russell, right, I could say that my rules would be representable as sort of a Boolean function. And Boolean functions can be represented, by the way, canonically as decision trees. So this is really not much of a bias. However, I can say smaller decision trees are better than larger decision trees, in which case there is a preference bias. If both you and your friend try to explain the data and your decision tree is smaller than your friend's, then I go with you. That's a preference bias. Okay? I could say it really is sort of a Bayes network. Okay? Russell weights basically determines wait time, patterns, Friday, etc. And given this, I can compute the posterior probability of Russell weighting. And all I need to learn then is the Bayes network structure. In this case, actually, the structure also is given, because if it's naive Bayes, where I assume that the label determines all the feature values. Okay? So this is a different bias. This is looking for Bayes network. And this is looking for neural networks. This is looking for association rules. Okay? It's basically like saying, given a bunch of points, looking for B splines that go through the point versus looking for some other kinds of polynomials that can be closely fit to those points. Okay? And based on the bias you have, there are learning algorithms that can efficiently tell you what is the best rule given that bias, or what is one of the better rules given that bias. Okay? Because once I tell you the hypothesis, once I tell you the space of hypothesis, and if the space of hypothesis is small enough, reasonable enough, then all I need to do is rank the hypothesis in terms of how well they fit to the training data. Okay? And then take the hypothesis that fits to the training data the best way. Okay? So, for example, for the Russell example, here are two hypotheses. One says Russell waits only in Italian restaurants. That's my rule. Rule two says Russell waits only in cheap French restaurants. Now, I can talk about whether or not they agree with the examples in terms of how many examples do they correctly classify. And when they fail to classify them correctly, how many examples that were originally negative are being classified as positive, which will be false positive, or how many examples which are originally positive got classified as negative, which is false negative. Okay? So in this case, if you can go back and look at it, H1 has one false positive and these many false negatives. H2 has no false positives and these many false negatives. Now, how do you decide which is a better hypothesis? You can decide, for example, go for the hypothesis that has the least number of the sum of positives and negatives, or you can say least number of false positives, in which case this guy will win, or you can say for each kind of error there is a cost and minimize the cost, which is a cost-based learning. So as an example, and this is really truly the last piece I'll tell you and you go home, in the medical domain, right? If you have false negatives, that means this guy comes in and he actually is going to die of cancer, and you say, hey, no cancer, go home. That's a huge cost. If you predict somebody who has a cancer that they don't have a cancer, they'll be happy for a couple of days and they'll sue you like crazy next day when they actually find that they have the thing. So in medical domain, false negatives have very high cost. Okay? It also does have cost for false positives. So, for example, being told suddenly that you go for a small blood test and the doctor says, yeah, by the way, everything is fine except you have the following disease and you might die tomorrow. Okay? And, you know, that's bad too. But probably not as bad as this. Okay? Depends on who are we talking about. This is really bad for the doctor because they can get sued to death. This is more bad for the patient, because for at least a couple of months, they will think they are about to die, and so their life happiness has reduced. Okay? So based on whose learning, whose happiness you're trying to optimize, you will give different values to this. Now, consider something like a spam mailer, who is trying to send mails to people such that if they might use that mail to buy something from them. Okay? Very low cost for false positives. If they may as well just assume that everybody is going to be happy about getting these catalogs, even if in fact very small number of people are. And in fact, email made this even lower cost, because email doesn't cost you a thing. And so you'll send everybody, okay, as a potential customer and send them these mails. Okay. But it's a higher cost for false negative. The problem with the spam mailer is, what if I forgot to send the mail to the one guy who's actually going to buy? I'll miss their dollars. Okay. So it's much better to assume that everybody is going to buy. The last one is identification of terrorists and criminals, et cetera, et cetera. The profiling, the racial profiling, all that stuff that we try to do. What's interesting, again, just like here, the cost is very high for false positives for the guy who was told you're a terrorist, who's not. Okay? But for the society, the cost is very high for a false negative, because if they miss a terrorist, presumably they'll go and blow up something. Supposedly. Right? So again, the point I'm trying to make here is, you can compare the hypothesis in terms of false positives and false negatives, but the relative cost for false positives and false negatives depends very much on what it is that you're trying to optimize. And oftentimes, the most interesting thing comes because you have to balance these, the societal versus, you know, individual benefits. And that's why you have rules such as, let 1,000 guilty go free than imprison a single innocent, okay? Which is the judicial thing where, because, you know, we don't want to put somebody in jail if they didn't actually do it. What that means is, you are ensuring that the individual's cost is being taken into account. And I actually like, as the very last comment, Chief Wiggum from Simpson says, let 1,000 guilty go free than chase after them. Which I think is a much nicer way of living. But we'll stop here. Next class, we will look at doing decision tree learning on this, and also Bayesian network learning on this data.